You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, I'm delighted to have as my guest, Reverend Bill McDonald. Reverend Bill's life has been a spiritual journey spanning 7 decades. He has been on a mystical trip in search of gurus, the paranormal, and self-discovery. He has written about his many spiritually transformative experiences and near-death experiences, including supernatural events during his combat tour of duty in the Vietnam War. His autobiography, Warrior, A Spiritual Odyssey, takes us on a life quest for love, understanding, forgiveness, and enlightenment. His follow-up book from April 2016, that's this month, Alchemy of a Warrior's Heart, continues that mystical journey, including several trips to India and profound experiences with holy men, miracles, and his personal relationship with the divine. What he knows for sure after all these years is that the only thing that is truly real is love. He is an author, award-winning poet, international motivational speaker, artist, film advisor, veteran advocate, a veteran of the Vietnam War, Distinguished Flying Cross, many other medals and ribbons and awards, and he has spoken around the world, including Germany and India, and has also been involved with a dozen films and documentaries. His mission in life is to inspire others to seek the divine, and he does that through his personal stories of his life experiences. You can find him on Facebook and on www.vietnamexp.com. You can just look in the show bio, and it will be listed there permanently. So let's welcome Reverend Bill to the show now. Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm feeling the heat from your fireside there. I'm looking at your picture. I'm looking at this picture of the Zany Mystic with a great hat on and with the fire going there. And it brings back great memories. Because like in India, I remember at the ashram in India sitting with Gurunath, my guru, and we're sitting at midnight, 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and he's got this fire going, and there's a circle of us sitting around it. And what he says, just hang on to it. It may be an hour and he doesn't say anything, and all of a sudden he says something for a while, and it's a beautiful experience. So to me, fireside chants are very special. And if you go back in history, that's why I'm kind of thrilled by the name of your show. Sitting around a campfire is where the medicine men, shamans, and the kahunas, and even the priests. Everything's kind of done around a fire. It's a very sacred thing. So it's very symbolic, and it feels very comfortable to be on your show. Thanks.
Well, I think even President Roosevelt had a fireside chat, didn't he?
Yeah, but was that more important than yours?
Oh, heavens no. He'll be long forgotten after this show. But anyway, I was reading your wonderful book, and it's just so personal and so moving and inspiring. Does it seem to you that there were certain key moments, and maybe perhaps they were all key moments, that were where you were intuitively guided, and it was very clear that there were certain defining moments in your journeys through the Vietnam War and with other people and with life and death? Feel free to talk about anything you want to mention, but it does seem that there is that thread that runs through your life. How does that feel to you?
You know what? It's interesting. Some people are born and they may have a experience or something happens to them along the way and it is profound. To me, it's the norm.
That's right.
What happens all the
time. Right.
You've got to realize that you read a book of just about 100 and some stories in there. They're all different, all mystical, all magical in some way, and nothing repetitive. and realized that the book that I originally wrote was twice that size, and I left out enough stories that would fill another volume of equal stuff. But there are some significant things. There were several significant things in my life growing up. One of them, to get back to your fireside chat, was when I was like 4 or 5 years old, I had this thing thinking I could walk through fire. I could walk through, you know, hot coals, you know, but at 4 or 5 year old, I wasn't thinking hot coals. I'm thinking fire. And you read that story in the beginning of my book there where I walk across a trash fire, and of course my whole body catches on fire, and I'm a big flaming shish kebab running around in some woman's
right.
face. But, so I'm not afraid to kind of step, if I have a feeling, I step out there and I do it. But when I was, 10, 11 years old, I was sick, and I was in the hospital in San Jose, in San Jose County Hospital, which is no longer in business. It's changed names and everything, but at that time I was made a ward of the hospital, and I spent about almost 12 months. If you can imagine, 12 months, a little boy, 12 months in the hospital.
Oh,
most
geez.
Of it isolated by myself. Most of it without any company visitors. I had visitors. My family came about 15, 20 minutes on Sundays. They didn't have a car. It was very difficult for them, so they show up. So I had a short little visit. And the rest of the week, it was just me. There was no toys, no books, no magazines, no television, no radio, no record player, no newspapers, and a lot of times no one else in the room. And the staff would come in, the nurses, the doctors, they take the blood, they take the temperature, take the vitals, and they'd leave until they had to come back for something else. So there was really no conversation. And you take a year of that and you think, oh, how terrible. And it was also total bed rest. I wasn't allowed to get up, explore, walk around, not even go to the bathroom. Everything was done in the bed. So I learned to focus at a very young age, inwardly. And I didn't get bored. I found a whole inner world through visions, dreams, mystical experiences and things that happened. And a near-death experience as well. I was laying there. I've been in the hospital about a week or two, and I was near death. And they told my parents at the time that, they weren't too sure I was going to pull through and everything. And so I was in isolation. And I'm laying there, and all of a sudden, the whole room is light. It's light. It's just everything else fades out, kind of like a movie. And there's no pain, there's no nothing. My mind is kind of blank, but I'm feeling great love. I'm feeling very loved. I'm feeling beyond love. And then I get this rollout of events in my future life, meeting my wife, who she was going to be, where I'm going to live, jobs I would have, Vietnam War experiences. And I had all these visions all the way up to about age 59 that I could ascertain. And except I kept having these other parts of the vision that kept rolling these numbers around. It was a 5-9, and it would flip to a 2-9. The 5 would look like a 2 flipped over. And I didn't know if I was going to die at 29 or 59. It was kind of like one of those iffy things. Anyway, so I experienced all these beautiful things in this near-death-like state. And later on in life, every single thing that I saw there came true, including what houses I moved into, me, my wife in my senior year. I met her, and I knew I was going to marry her. That was it. This is the person, right?
Uh-huh.
And we've been, and you know, it's been that way ever since. So it was not a lot of surprises in my life. But up at 59 years old, I went to India just before my 59th birthday. I was in India. This is in my newest book that will be coming out. And I was going to a place called Babaji's Cave. Now, for those that have read the autobiography of a yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, they're familiar with Babaji and they're familiar with the cave experience where he appeared to one of his devotees, Larry Masha, and retaught Kriya Yoga, which is the Kundalini raising energy meditation, brought back into the world. Anyway, it's a very sacred place, and I wanted to go there. And so I made this trip to India, and it was very difficult to find there, very difficult to get there. And I get there at the ashram that guards this cave, basically the gatekeepers, and it's hidden away in this mountain. And I finally got instructions how to go there. We get there. Me and my buddy Dave, we get lost going up there. I'm sick. I got, I'm just really, really sick. I'm having heart problems. I'm having seizures. All kinds of things are happening. But I finally get to the top. We reach the cave. And I had brought along this list of names of everybody I could think of. I went to my computer before I left, and I typed the name of everybody I ever knew or ever met, had a good relationship with, a bad relationship with, an enemy, a friend, didn't make any difference. I figured everybody needs prayers, and we're all one, right? Mm. So I created this list. It was 4 pages long, and it was just name after name after name, just typed line after line after line. And I took it into Babaji's cave, and I mentally read off all the names. And I meditated, and I was there a while, and it was like, these people couldn't take this sacred journey with me, but I was going to bring these people with me on this journey. So I did that, and then I'm getting dizzy and everything. So I finally, to make a long story short, we got lost leaving there. I'm really lost, and I'm having some real bad chest pains. I'm having a heart attack. I'm standing on this cliff. It's about a 30-foot cliff, and I pass out. And I fall off this 30-foot cliff in the Himalayan mountains.
Oh, geez.
Now, thankfully, well, it sounds worse than it is, but because it wasn't straight down, it was kind of angled so you'd only fall 10 feet three times. So 10 feet bounce, another 10-foot bounce, then bounce on a rock. So only three drops of 10 feet each, you know. So, and I'm laying on this rock on my back, boulder, and I'm looking up at the sky, and it's like that cartoon TV show, The Simpsons. Simpsons, you know, the sky opens up. It was kind of like that. And I'm laying there, and my chest is just pounding. And then all of a sudden, there is no pain. There is no pounding. And I'm looking down at myself laying on the rock.
Mm.
And I'm going, wow, this is kind of cool. Well, at least I got to go to Babaji's cave, right? This is good. And I'm almost 59, so I'm thinking, okay, maybe this is the end of the road. And then, as I'm laying there, looking down at myself, I see this huge cobra. Now, when I say huge, I have no clue how big it was, but every time I tell the story, it gets bigger. I think the first time I told the story, it was 7 foot, and I think my wife corrected me one day when I said it was 12. But I'm Irish. Anyway, it was a big
right.
Anyway, and you couldn't tell how big it was because it never was fully exposed. It came out of grass, crossed over my boots with its hooded head, and then it went into the grass. So I never could see its full body. But to me, it was huge. And it excited me so much that it was like somebody took defibrillator paddles and put them on my chest. It was like, clear! Boom!
Mm.
And I jumped off the rock, took a breath, and it's like, wow. And I tried to grab the cobra, and I kept grabbing this cobra, and it was slithering through my fingers. We're talking about not defanged cobra. We're talking about the real deal here. And I chased it down this trail, and then it went behind this waterfall, and this beautiful waterfall. And I just stood there looking at it. And then the story from the autobiography of the yogi came back to me where it talks about Larry Masha. When he had his experience with Babaji, he went down to bathe in a waterfall, cold waterfall. And I'm looking at it thinking, wow, nobody ever knew where that waterfall was. And I was lost. I had no clue where I was at. I could never find it again, save my life. But I got it, the cobra actually saved my life. And I know because when I got back to the States a couple months later, it shows you I don't go to doctors. A couple months later, I had another heart attack. And I go in there, and I'm moaning and groaning to the doctor. This is just about 3, 4, or 5 weeks before my 59th birthday. Remember, that was the visions I had, 59 looked like the end, right?
Yeah, right.
And I'm complaining to the doctor, and I'm saying, hey, doc, I said, how unfair is this? I said, here I am. I got diabetes. I got congestive heart failure. I got heart disease. I got epilepsy. I got all these things going on. And I said, and I don't smoke, never smoked, never drank any booze, didn't do any drugs, didn't do sugar, didn't do chocolate, didn't do alcohol, don't do cakes, don't do pies, don't use salt, don't use sugar.
And you're Irish?
I mean, yeah, you know, and on top of that, you know, I'm meditating and doing yoga, and I was in good shape. And yet, genetically, I was prone to all these things. Of course, I find out years later from the VA that Agent Orange gave me a pension. Agent Orange caused the heart problems and the diabetes.
Oh, and that was was developed by Monsanto, wasn't it?
You got it. Anyway, that's another whole story. Anyway, so I'm at the doctor. And then after I tell him this whole thing about how pure my life was, how come this is happening? And then he looks at me, and this goes back to that childhood thing about 2959. He looks at me and he says, well, Mr. McDonald, he says, had you not taken all those precautions in your life, being a vegetarian, not booze, no drugs, all that stuff, he says, you had been dead at 29 with your genetics.
Mm.
That just out of the blue. And I go, wow. And he says, now you're looking at 59 in a few weeks. And he says, you know, and maybe we can save you. So there's a 29-59 coming into play. See, so it's like, maybe I was really programmed to go at 29. And had I not became a vegetarian the week after I left the hospital, after a year, I came home, I was the only one in my family. I became a vegetarian and I got into yoga and I changed my lifestyle at 9, 10, 11 years old. And not a lot of people do that. So that was the beginning of several experiences. I'm kind of glossing over Vietnam where supernatural things happened and story after story of things happened. But those two events kind of tied together. And so that got me to 59. And now I'm in my 70s. And I know I got not that much sand left in the hourglass. In fact, in one of my subsequent trips to India, where my guru told me to go get my nadi palm reading done, and when he told me that, I didn't even know what he was talking about. What's a nadi? I'm thinking nadi like your naughty boy, right? And palm, I'm thinking of reading the hand, for exercise, a fortune telling or something. He says, no, it's just not what it is. So explain to me, because I don't know if people out there listening even know what a nadi palm reading is, because I didn't. But it's a reading that they do of souls that reincarnate into life.
Mm-hmm.
And it said that those that need the information will come to one of these places in India where they have these records, and there'll be information for that person on what their mission in life is, what their purpose, why they're here, what they're doing. In other words, kind of an instruction sheet of things. And they were written 2,500 to 5,000 years ago, these great rishis, these sages in India, sat down and channeled information out, and then these scribes would write it down on palm leaves. That's where the palm comes in. You know, they cut off the frilly part, and it's just on the solid palm, and then they would shellac it to save it so it wouldn't, you know. But unfortunately, those things only last about 700-800 years, then they start to dissolve, and some other scribe does it. So after a few thousand years, some of them may have been redone a few times, so some things may have changed, you know, so it's altered, not in a pure state. So he tells me that, and I'm going, yeah, okay, great, I don't believe in this. And then on top of that, they had all these things in one place back in the 1800s when the British were there, and there was the room where they were stored, which was at my guru's wife's palace or library, destroyed a bunch of them. It was decided to take them and send them to various places around the country of India, and they just divided them up. So I think I've heard anywhere between 15 and 20 locations where they're at. So even if you had one of these things done, you'd have to figure out where it was at, and then when you go in, they find your reading by taking your right thumbprint. If you're a man, if you're a woman, they take their left thumbprint. So using your thumbprint only is how they find, from these millions of things they got, millions of them apparently, they find your thing. And So after I was told all that, now I really don't believe it, right? I'm going, yeah, okay, great. What's the odds on this? So I'm thinking it's like a Vegas, you know, mental attack. They're going to read me, you know, and so don't wear any wedding rings, you know, don't say anything, you know, don't tell them your name, don't tell them nothing. So I told my guru I didn't believe it. He said, for you, it's going to be true. You go. I'm giving you an order. You go. I said, okay, I'm only going because you're telling me to go because I don't think I need it. He says, you go. And he says, make sure you ask about a significant past life's sin because that's something you need to work on, and that will also show your connection to why you're here today. I said, okay. So I go down to this place in Pune, which is about 3-4 hours south of Mumbai if you drive. And it's an alley. No big signage that I could figure out. You go in there and you take your thumbprint, and the guy says, put your initial next to your thumbprint. So I put W, because I never go by William. I always go by Bill. I figure, okay, maybe they'll figure that out. Let's see how good they are, right? So I sit down, and an hour later, they bring me into this little room. It's picture a room about the size of a small bedroom with an altar with, you know, Indian idols and statues of gods all around the place, and there's probably 50 incense sticks burning, and there's flower lays. I mean, it's just, it feels sacred when you walk in there. But, and the guy gets out there, and I'm sitting there, I'm looking at all this stuff, and he says, okay. And he brings this pile of palm leaves out, and they got a hole through them, much like Phoenician blinds, where he's got a cord running through them, and they're all kind of strung together. And he says, okay, he says, I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and as soon as you say no to one of them, then we stop reading that one that's not you. Mm-hmm. You have to answer yes to a single question before it's you. So he goes through the first six, and it was close, but then I got a couple of no answers. And then he gets to the seventh one. He says, okay, this one, he says, intuitively, I personally feel this is yours. And I said, okay, go ahead. So he says, your name is 4 letters long. I'm thinking, okay, Bill, maybe you'll get something here. And he goes, it starts with B. I go, yeah. And then he goes, it's Bill. And I look on the thing, and in English it's spelled B-I-L-L, and it's got all this other weird writing. And it's old, right? I said, okay, that's pretty good. Okay, interesting. He says, and now your father's name was, being he's dead, was the same as yours. I'm Junior. So it was absolutely the same as mine. He was Senior. And then he goes, your mother's name, and he couldn't pronounce it correctly, but he spelled it out, Marcella, which is an Italian name. And this is in India, they got this thing written, right? And I'm going, wow. And he says, both your parents have been deceased 3-4 decades. I go, yes. And he says, we don't have a word for this in our country, but you were kind of like a foster kid or an orphan or something, but one year, at least one year or your parents wasn't around for sometime in your life. And sometime in your life, neither were around, which is true. I was a year in the hospital all by myself. So I said, okay, yes. And then he goes, and your wife's name is Carol. I'm going, holy cow, man, that's, you know, it's impressive, right? I mean, you know, it's a lot of things he could have pulled out.
Mm.
And then and he goes, and she was educated at a university, and she's got a degree in psychology or social work. I go, yes. And he goes through a whole bunch of stuff. And then he goes, you got 2 children, a boy first, then a girl. They're both married. They both have children. I go, yes, yes. And he says, you got a good relationship with them both. I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I assume so. You'd have to ask them, but I think I do. And then he goes, your birthday. I don't think he's going to give me a basic, you know, roundabout park something. He goes, your birthday is March 16th, 1946. I'm going, wow, that's a pretty good guess, okay? It's a lot of days. And then he goes, but we're not certain of the hour that you're born. It could have been 110, 115, 120. We're not sure. And what was funny when he said that, he didn't know that, but on my birth certificate, because I was partially, I came out. I mean, I was practically delivered. And they held up the delivery till the doctor get there, so I was already born. And so the doctor took a guess at my time, and they guessed, they weren't sure if I was born at 110, 115, or 120. They took a guess someplace and put it on the birth certificate. So it's interesting, in the reading, they had the same problem.
Oh,
I thought
yeah.
That was kind of odd. And then it goes through the whole thing. He says, okay, now he says, here's the next question. And this question is going to tell us if this is the proper time that you were supposed to come to us for this reading.
Oh.
I said, oh, there's a special time you got to come. Yeah. By the stars and everything else, you will know this was the time that you were supposed to get this information. Because had you come in last year, this wouldn't be relevant, this question. And if you come in next year, it wouldn't be relevant. I said, okay, what is it? And he says, I'm using my intuition on this. He says, because on this palm leaf, it says something different. He says, on the palm leaf, it says, you recently worked on a play. He says, but my intuition says, you recently worked on a movie. And I'm going, whoa, that's a pretty good catch, right? And not as an actor. And the thing was, three weeks before I left to go to India, I rewrote a screenplay, or for the film Trooper, because I didn't like the ending because it wasn't happy and it didn't have a good positive ending. And I told the director, and Chris Martini, a great guy. And I told him, I said, you got to change the ending. And I showed him how to do it. I wrote it on a napkin and stuff. Here's some dialogue. Here's what to do. Blah blah blah. I gave him a real inexpensive way to produce it and do it. And nobody knew that in India at all. But my wife didn't even know that. So had I come in at a different time, that answer wouldn't have been true, because I don't work on movies all the time, trust me. And it was a very significant thing. So then it went on through and it said, you write books, you write nonfiction books, you write spiritual books, and you're going to be writing books about your own guru. Which is true, which at the time I was actually writing one about my guru. And it went through my purpose of life and why I'm here, and just went 40 more questions. And it was all right on. I go, wow. So I was impressed he got done, so I got my money out to pay the guy. And he goes, no. That's not your reading. He says, that's just the index card. Now we know who you are, and we'll give you a reading at 8 o'clock today. I go, what? He says, that's just, we want to make sure we have the right charts. So about 6 hours later, they bring me upstairs, and they got a guy that reads it from one language, ancient language, and reads and interprets it to another Indian language. And then I had an Indian there to interpret from that second language to English. So it was a process. And what they did was they read the most significant past life, something that affects me today, and would show me why I needed to be there and why I needed to deal with this. And so they went back to a significant life, which was in Sri Lanka, and wasn't called that back then, of course. And I was at an ashram, and I was the senior. I ran the ashram for the guru, and the guru was my present-day guru. And apparently my greatest sin of that entire lifetime was a thought. I had a lustful thought for a married woman, and the guru picked up on it and put a curse on my mind and sent me out of the ashram, and I wandered around until years later, according to their charts, I was bathing in the Ganges River, and I come up out of the river to a brightness of Lord Shiva standing there. Of course, you can't see Shiva if you're alive, right? You're dying, right? And shoot, and I leave in a rainbow body, and according to them, I've been living in a rainbow body for every lifetime they could go back through. So it was a significant thing. They don't usually have readings like that, they said. I said, okay, big deal. Now realize this stuff they're telling me, I'm not making this up, and I don't necessarily believe it all, but I'll tell you what they told me. It makes a good story. So I thought, geez, I got a curse by my guru. And so the guy goes, well, think about it. He messed up your head. He put a curse on your head, so you're kind of like a fool when you left there. You weren't thinking straight. And what happened to you this lifetime? Well, this lifetime, when I first met my guru, without me telling him anything was wrong, I was having brain seizures. I was having about over 200 and something of seizures a year. Fought on from getting blown up in Vietnam. I had a traumatic brain injury, and it just went into epilepsy. And so I was at a point where I couldn't drive, I couldn't function. And I visited him, and I never let on that I was having a problem. And he cured it. I mean, I didn't ask for it. He just charted. It's another whole story that I don't have time, but it's a long story. But it was like gone. So the guy's telling me, he says, well, when you met your guru, the first thing he did within 90 minutes of meeting you, he cured you of your brain problem, right? Yeah. And lifted the curse. And so I was worried about that curse thing. So when I talked to my guru, I'm like, what is this curse? He says, I don't worry about it. He says, because it's all part of the great play. Because he had to do that lifetime. So this lifetime, we'd reconnect, and I would understand the thing. And it was all just part of the great show. Anyway, so the reading went on. So that was just the past life, which is entertaining, but you can't prove anything about anybody's past lives. Like, I was listening to the shows before your show, and the lady was going in past lives about people in Civil War and stuff. And I'm thinking, you can never double-check that stuff. You know, you have no clue.
Right.
You know, great. You can tell anybody anything. I mean, she could be right and she could be wrong. Who knows? But then they go into your present life. And the guy started from childhood, worked all the way up. And it was 100%, man. It was like boom, 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 boom. All the way up to me walking in there. I go, wow, you got the present pretty good. I'm impressed. And then he says, okay, now here's your future. And so he went into the future, and he told me a bunch of things, including future health problems, death of myself, when that was going to happen, how, and plus my mission in life, like writing this new book I got coming out, that's something I was supposed to do. I was supposed to tell my spiritual stories. See, because in India, they got this thing that some people think lesser of you if you tell spiritual stories. Because it's supposed to be your secret experience. You're not supposed to share them with anybody because it takes something away. I've been given orders in my Nadi reading, also by my guru, also in visions and Vedic charts and card readings and everything else. They've all told me the same thing independently. I'm supposed to tell these stories, even though some people will look upon it and judge me for telling the stories. You know, because, you know, it's like, where's your humility? So I learned my purpose and why I'm here and what I'm supposed to do and how much time I got, and that's what I've been kind of doing. And it's just been one event after another event after another event. And I haven't given you any chances to ask any questions in turn. I'm sorry. I get rolling. I do workshops, and I do, like, I'm going to United Kingdom, and I'll be talking to groups, and I'm usually scheduled for anywhere from an hour to 90 minutes. I usually end up going 4 to 6 to 8 hours because I just take questions nonstop. And it goes as long as we got the building, because I have probably 3,000 or 4,000 personal stories. And I never repeat. And when I'm doing an audience, live audience, I never prepare anything.
Right,
if you're going to come to... If I was going to do a workshop up in Placerville, let's say, and you had a bunch of people show up there, I would not prepare anything. I'd have nothing prepared. I'd walk up full blank. And when I normally introduced, I don't do this on the radio because it doesn't work too good. People go, what's the silence? But when I'm introduced to a person, I usually stand there, and I just watch the audience. I look at all their eyes, I scan. And people aren't used to somebody getting up there and just standing there and not saying anything for 30 seconds or 45 seconds. You know, it's like a lifetime in the entertainment business. You know, it's like most speakers get up and they want to get going right away. You know, they want to, let's get it going. In fact, most speakers, when they pause, they go, and they try to fill it in with things because they're uncomfortable with the breaks and the silence between thoughts and words. And I don't work that way. So when I work an audience, I read the audience. Why are they here? What do they need? I mean, I can say, here's what I'd like to give you, but I don't do that. So, therefore, I've given hundreds of these workshops and talks across the country and around the world, and none of them have ever been repetitive. None of them have ever been the same in any form, shape, or manner. So, I may tell a story or two the same, but individual questions and what I emphasize, and I'll pick somebody out in the audience, I'll pick up on something like, I did a workshop in Orlando last year, and I was picking up on various personal problems and things with people, so I was taking the lecture that direction because I feel that's what people were getting. And I find out later on that I was, of course, hitting the targets. But I never questioned. I think you're the same way, Lance. What I'm picking up from you is you follow your inner voice. You don't question it too much. If someone says jump, you jump.
Mm-hmm.
And you've learned to trust it. I've learned to trust mine. And that's how I function. And so in Vietnam, this, you could call it a skill, you could call it an art, you could call it a gift, you could call it a blessing, or you could call it a curse. But I knew who was going to get killed.
Huh.
What airplanes, what helicopters were going to crash, who was going to get wounded, what was going to happen. And so even though I was awarded, and if you go online, you'll find out, I had a lot of medals and awards, ribbons and stuff, and it was, oh, brave guy. No, I wasn't brave. The brave guy is the guy out there that has no idea what's going to happen and thinks that there's a possibility he's going to get blown apart, and he does something. That's a hero. Me? I knew what was going to happen.
Didn't you also exert a little bit of independence when you were over there? There was a story, I think, in the beginning where you were talking about having refused to kill a certain group of people. You just weren't going to go out on whatever the command was, and the person who was above you was just furious and said, you will go out, and you and another person then stepped in and said, no, I'm not going to either, and it turned out that you would have been right. I thought that was an interesting story.
Actually, you asked about pivotal things in my life. Now, think about the negative pivotal result. Here was the case. I had a major, West Point graduate, hell of a nice guy, turns out later on. It was a pivotal point in his life, too. But we're flying over this, what they call free fire zone, which means we didn't have to call into Saigon to get permission to fire back or to shoot. We saw an enemy, we were allowed to shoot. That sounds like what? In Vietnam, there were certain places you flew, and they're shooting at you, and you had to call Saigon 30, 40 miles away and say, hey, they're shooting at us in this sector. Can we fire back? And then, well, just a minute, we'll get somebody. Then, you could be 3, 4, 5 minutes later, and they get back to you saying, oh, yeah, you can fire back. Well, you already shot down, right?
Mm.
So, that was the reality. So we're flying over this jungle, and there's this dirt road coming out of a small village, and there's formation of people walking down the road. There's 30 people, and there's somebody in the front. Everybody's wearing black pajamas, and the guy in the front's got black, some kind of clothing on. And they all look like they looked like, from up in the air, everybody was carrying some kind of weapon over their shoulders.
Hmm.
Well, my pilot is giving me a direct order, saying, fire at them. Hey, McDonald, fire at those guys. Or he called me Mac. Hey, Mac, fire at those guys. And I'm saying, no, sir. My intuition, what I'm feeling is, that's wrong.
They're not
being. And he's giving me this lengthy thing about he's in charge, he's giving me a direct order in combat, failure to do so is a court-martial offense. I'm looking at 20 years in jail for not...
Oh, yeah.
And I said, do whatever you're going to do. People don't realize how serious that is. So then he turns the helicopter around for the gunner to fire from the other side. We have machine guns, M60 machine guns. And to my surprise, and actually... to my worry as well, because this guy's trusting my judgment. He's going, I've been flying with McDonald for 6 months. If McDonald's feelings are that we shouldn't fire, I'm not firing. And he refused to fire. And then we were told, anytime you get two or more soldiers conspiring together not to fight and disobey a direct order, that is mutiny. That's a death penalty or life in jail.
Oh, yeah.
And so he's reminding us, death penalty. So here we are facing... death, firing squad, the Army will fool around, or life in Fort Leavenworth, no parole, for mutiny. Now, how many young guys, 20, 21 years old, would have just said, okay, it's your responsibility, I can't fire, I ain't going to go to jail, right? Neither one of us fired.
Wow.
So, but yeah, that was heavy. That was something that took more bravery than all the medals I got.
Oh, yeah,
and I got
sure.
Flying Cross, Bronze Star, all these other things that I'm thinking. The one thing I did that took the most guts, me and my door gunner didn't get nothing for it, not even a thank you. Anyway, so I told the pilot, I go, look, take a pass, fly down there really low. I got my machine gun. They're bad guys. They're going to shoot at me. I'll shoot back. We'll take them out. So he said, okay. We flew down there, and it turns out that it was a group of 30 children from the village and a Catholic priest in front of them. They're carrying gardening tools on their shoulders.
Oh, my goodness.
To the vegetable garden that's outside the village.
Wow.
To work on vegetable gardens. We would have killed 30 kids and a priest. Now, you've been around long enough to know that's got to be at least a cardinal sin.
At least.
And 30 kids on top of that, right? Now, how would any of us, the pilots, door gunners, how would have any of us ever have survived emotionally and spiritually that?
Oh, my God. It would have destroyed every one of you.
So I was willing to sacrifice my life in jail to prevent that. But the guy was most courageous is my door gunner because he was trusting me. I mean, that's gutsy. I'm going, like, I'm pretty certain, right? Of course, then when he did that, I'm thinking, God, I better be certain, right? It's like, I just put me and him in jail. So, yeah. But Vietnam was like that. I followed my instincts. Things happened. A lot of unusual things happened. One thing that happened was kind of odd. When I got shot down one day. Helicopter got riddled. And we dropped off this South Vietnamese officer on the ground. And it turned out he was like a double agent. He was actually working both sides. He was one of the other guys, right? He turns around with an automatic weapon. And
oh.
He puts an 18-round clip in his gun. And he takes aim right at my chest. And just as I turn around, I see white light come at me. And he empties 18 rounds right into my chest. I just got a chest protector, a ceramic chest protector, to try out for 3 days. It's the third day I had it. Me and the gunner are going, oh, I don't know if I want this, right? So we took the back plate out, and we put that plate underneath our canvas seat to protect our family jewels,
mm-hmm.
and we left the front plate on. But we did have rounds come up from underneath. You know, you could have rounds come up, hit you in the butt and everything. So all we had is the front chest plate on, but we didn't know if it was going to work or not. Nobody knew if it was going to work or not. We were the guinea pig. We were trying them out for the unit. So one round hits right square, right in my heart. And it knocks me back against the wall of the helicopter. It takes my breath away. It's like, I don't know, they watch these guys moving. They got a chest protector on or some kind of armor protecting thing, you know, and it's a bulletproof vest. I tell you what, it will knock you down anyway, and it will bruise you. It will take the wind out of you, and you feel like you just been tackled by, you know, some big 300-pound football player. So it takes you out. So I got hit with that round, and I looked down at my chest, and there's smoke and fire pouring out of this chest protector. It's like, poosh. And
you could have roasted some weenies and marshmallows on you.
Yeah, and then the cord that went to my helmet for the radios broke. So all of a sudden it went silent. So I'm thinking, wow, am I dead? Because I'm looking down, I got a hole in my heart, right?
Wow.
You know, and smoke and flames coming out of it.
Jeepers, a superhero.
Yeah, so apparently the guy very must have been a tracer that had that smoke and the fire coming out. So anyway, we pulled up, and we only went maybe 100 yards, and we crashed. And I got out, and I got the pilots out. And I went around the other side of the helicopter. The door gunner was slumped over his machine gun. And he had 17 holes in his back. He had all these wounds, but there were 17 actual holes in the wall behind him. And we were sitting silhouetted back to back. If I was sitting facing out one direction, he's facing the opposite direction on the other side of the helicopter. And so any round coming to me actually wouldn't get to him because there's a transmission in the middle. So somehow one round hit me in the heart. And 17 rounds somehow went around my body because they came out on the other side where his back was at, which is exactly where my back is at on the other side. And he got wounded. He got wounded in the chest, the buttocks, the shoulder, the side, all the backs. He had blood everywhere. So I threw him on my shoulder. I ran through the jungle because the bad guys were coming. Now, you can picture picking up a guy about 160 pounds. I was about 140. And I got this guy on my shoulder, and you're running.
Oh, geez.
You know, back was all messed up. Anyway, so a helicopter comes. It's a small helicopter, a gunship. Only could take the wounded guy. Of course, I got a wound in my hand, but nobody pays attention. And they take the major, and they left me and this captain there, this black guy, a real great pilot. I can't remember his name. And they took off, and they left us. They got no room. And there's 500 North Vietnamese troops on the ground, and there's me and him. He's got a 45, and so we run back to the helicopter, and I pull off M60 machine gun off the helicopter, and I take a 2,000-round clip, put it in there, and I put it down on my waist. I said, to hell with this. I ain't waiting for them to come to get me. We're going to go get them. Of course, the captain thought I was crazy. But I told him, I said, just cover my back with your pistol, right? So we walked towards the enemy, and I just opened up, firing 750 rounds a minute. And, of course, a couple of minutes, you fired about 1,500 rounds. And what I didn't know was on the ground when you're firing a machine gun, it's different than firing it in the air when you're going 100 miles an hour. You got wind cooling the barrel, right? Uh-huh. You got the rotor blade cooling the barrel. But on the ground, machine gunners, contrary to what the movies show, you know, the guys fire nonstop. On the ground, you fire. Every time you see a tracer, you stop. You pull the trigger, fire five rounds, you let go. Five rounds at a time, otherwise you overheat the barrel. I didn't know that. So all of a sudden, I'm firing about 1,500, 1,800 rounds, and all of a sudden there's this click. And I can't fire any more rounds. And I'm looking at the barrel, and it's like white hot. It's,
ooh.
It's, and it's bent. It's
Uh-oh.
Actually bent.
Wow.
I didn't think it was possible. And so I go, oh, geez. And of course, you know, the military is wise. They don't give you, you don't have white T-shirts, white handkerchiefs, white underwear, white socks.
Right.
So you can't give up. You got nothing to wave this white, right? It's like, holy cow, it's so deep. And, anyway, so to make a long story short, they chased us through the jungle. 8 hours later, after escaping and evading, we finally got rescued. But here's the story. When they came back and got the crashed helicopter and brought it back to base, they sent out an investigation team from the Army trying to figure out how I could only have one bullet hit me, and on my side of the helicopter, behind me, there's not one entry hole, but on the other side, there's 17 exit holes.
Oh.
And so I told them my theory, but they didn't want to believe it, and they laughed at me and everything. But they were out there 3 days investigating, special team. Now, that's 1967. April 14th, 1967. I remember that because I got a Purple Heart and Distinguished Flying Cross that day. But 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I'm sitting around and I get a phone call from Langley, Virginia. My phone says Langley, Virginia. There's an ID, right? And I go, what in the hell? It's a contractor for the CIA. Mm. And it was some doctor something, some engineer, that had my file in front of him. And the Army actually had a file on that and also a file on another thing that happened to me over there where I told which helicopters were going to crash and burn. They actually had a file on that as well. But apparently what I didn't know, the Army had kind of like an X file.
Oh, yeah, really?
Yeah, I don't think I've talked about this on radio before.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay. They were actually studying people like me, but never let us know it. And later on at Stanford University, because I know Dr. David Morehouse, and then there's a guy who wrote a foreword for his book, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, great book, by the way. And they talk about remote viewing.
Right.
The military developed with the CIA, where they go into these dark rooms and they can try to find and locate missing airplanes or see what's going on in some place, kind of like spying, remote viewing. And then these guys were very successful, but after a while, then Congress and everybody poo-bought it, and they got rid of it. But I don't think it's really gotten rid of it. I think it's just changed names and stuff. But it's evident to me that our military, especially like the Air Force, they had their Blue Book thing. Well, I think the Army's got this X-File thing. So anyway, so I tried to get information out of this guy. I said, hey, look, you're trying to get information. You want to know how I did this thing. He said, how'd you manage to have these bullets go around you? He says, I'm trying to engineer this. I got like $28 million budget to try to duplicate what you did. Can you help us? I go, well, do you want to meditate? Do you want to learn Kriya Yoga? I mean, do you want to, you know? And they want to buy it. I'm telling them, this is something they're not going to be able to do. It's an individual thing, right? It's mystical. The guy wanted a mechanical way to do it. He figures he could engineer it, right? Anything he could do, he could engineer. So I said, well, what do you got in the file? He said, I can't read it to you. It's top secret. I said, well, who's in it? He said, well, it's you. And I said, you mean you got a file on me that's 40-something years old, and it's all about me, but you can't tell me one thing it says? He says, I've already revealed more than you're supposed to know. And then there's the end of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting because they came out and poo-bought me and the company.
Uh-huh.
Official told them what helicopters were going to crash. They made big fun of me. And then I find out 47 years later, they actually had a file where they actually were studying it and actually believed everything I said. Crazy stuff. Anyway, so Vietnam was like that. Neat things happened. Beautiful things happened. And I'm saying that, and somebody out there that's not a warrior person is, how can you talk about Vietnam, beautiful things happen? I'm telling you, no matter where you're at, God is at. The divine mind is there.
Mm-hmm.
You know it in your life, and others know it. It's not what happens to you. It's all about how you handle it. Nothing's good. Nothing's bad. Nothing's evil. Nothing's great. I mean, it's just stuff that happens. And it's how you use those gifts that come to you. I mean, the gifts of pain and cancer, the gifts of being in war, the gifts of good things, bad things that people judge. I don't judge anything anymore. Everything is a gift. And so that's how I lead my life. You kind of started this conversation off on what pivotal points. I have thousands of pivotal points, great things that happen. And I tell you what, you bring me back on the show, we could talk about some things that... astral travel and rainbow bodies and double body experiences and mind reading and levitation and all kinds of other things. I'm telling you that in UFOs, alien abductions, the whole gauntlet of experiences, if you're open, if your heart and mind is open, if you have the belief of a child, you know, children see things. They see ghosts, they see angels because their mind doesn't block it out. When you become an adult, you've been told over and over that's not real, you no longer see those things. Your mind won't accept it. Even if an angel stands in front of you, you won't see it. And I've had experiences where a vision happened and four people in the room and only, you know, the other people don't see anything, but one of the persons sees it, exactly what I see. So I'm saying that people have to be at a certain level of belief. It's the old thing. If you believe it, you will see it. If you don't believe it, it ain't going to happen.
Well, absolutely, and it does seem that people, especially are through peers and parents, are conditioned to halt anything that is outside the norm. So when kids are seeing things that their parents can't see because they have adopted belief systems which are limited, then there's no agreement there, and so they have to tell the children that they're not seeing it or they're imagining things or that they're crazy or whatever. And so, unfortunately, that has been the way it has been in the past, but I think you and I know, and I think the kids know, that they're seeing real things, and they're going to see more of those real things as the next few years unfold, and they need to get the encouragement that they are actually seeing things and get some validation from the people around them and not criticism and laughter.
Because you know these young people, think about this, the young people, my grandchildren, there's a generation out there that is spiritually advanced. This is this group coming in. I mean, there's all kinds of, you got people at the top, you got people, like there's a spectrum. But there's a group, call them Hindu children, call them...
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of names people come up for them, but this group sees things, feels things, sense things. I have great hope for the future. I'm not one of these people that put down this younger generation. I'm looking at this younger generation with great hope and faith. This is a very accepting society out there. I mean, my grandkids, they got friends of every shade and rainbow color you got, and every kind of religious backgrounds. But they don't think about that. They don't divide them up and don't even classify them or identify them that way. It's only older adults that do.
Right. Looking back at your war years and all of the traumatic things that happened to you, what is your honest feeling about the need for human beings to kill each other in such horrific ways and the trauma that it produces and the waste of money? Don't you think it's a wiser choice that we learn how to end this kind of ridiculous and childish behavior?
Well, ideally, yeah, but reality.
Now you're going to create reality. I think that we can.
But here's the thing. For all that evil out there and all these wars, it's also bringing to the fold higher levels of spirituality. Without evil people, you don't have high spiritual people. In other words, you don't have the heroes can't come forth. So from this burst of terrible stuff going on out right there now, you've got counteracting energies. You've got some great spiritual beings in the Himalayas and various places that are counteracting this. And as a group, this group soul of ours, this whole group of us, we're evolving, even though it doesn't look like it. We don't have World War II level stuff anymore. We got wars here and there, little stuff.
It does make sense.
But we're not exterminating 6 million and we're not 20 million Russians killed. So it's changing, and now we got communication, so we know. And we hurt for the child that's killed in collateral damage in Syria, right? We're hurting for that. But 20 million people killed in Russia, it's like, you know, 6 million Jews. So we have come a long ways. The consciousness of this world is changing and evolving, and I am very pleased.
Two minutes, 1 minute.
Well, you know, we're coming to the last minute of the show. It's been so interesting to hear your stories that the time just flew by. So I want to thank you for being on tonight. And if there's anything you want to close with briefly and mention where you'll be and about your book and the rest of it, then this would be a good time to do it.
Okay, I'm going to be going to Florida. I'll be in Tampa. Giving a lecture, and I'll have some information on my Facebook page on that shortly. And I'll be doing something in Orlando, and then I'm helping the Catholic Church up in Jacksonville area with a retreat for adults with mental disabilities. And then I'll be doing workshops and lectures in the United Kingdom, and I'll be going to Wales, England, Scotland, and probably Northern Ireland.
Wow.
And my lectures are all free. My workshops are all free. I accept love donations. So someone wants to buy my book, Warrior, A Spiritual Odyssey, which you can get on Amazon. It's a download. It's a paperback. And you can get it in an audiobook. And any money sold from that is going to help my Spiritual Warrior Ministries. And basically, I work with veterans on what I call morally injured veterans. Because it's more than just PTSD. There's the guilt associated with taking lives and fighting a war, and which goes against the whole common principle of the spiritual center. So that's kind of what I'm doing.
Well, wonderful, Bill. And I consider it a great pleasure to talk with you tonight, and I'm sure that the people that meet you in those places will have a real treat in store for them. So thank you again for being on the show.
God bless.
All right. Good night.